funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long did the horrors of the Second World War last in Europe? When Allied forces claimed victory over the Third Reich in May of 1945, millions of people on both sides of the conflict still faced years of upheaval, hardship, and even violence as a new world order was established and old scores remained to be settled. Historian and author Keith Lowe explores this time of fear, deprivation, and bitterness in his new book, Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. Keith, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
This book was a stark reminder to me, as an American, of how skewed the dominant narrative is in this country of the years that followed the war. Our soldiers came home. The country was financially strong, physically intact, prosperous. Huge sections of Europe, on the other hand, were quite literally in ruins.
Absolutely. I mean, we have this wonderful image, don't we, that the image that really springs to mind whenever I think of the end of the war is that that famous one of that American sailor kissing the nurse in New York's Times Square, which is a lovely image because it gives a sort of fairy tale ending to the war, doesn't it? But actually, on the ground in Europe, there was precious little kissing in that way. There was just a lot of chaos, a lot of destruction, and as you say, continuing violence for months, if not years, after the war was supposed to be over.
Give us a sense of the scope of that devastation. There were places where 90% of cities had been razed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Warsaw is the example I give at the beginning of the book, because that city had been destroyed systematically, house by house, street by street, as the Germans left it in 1944. But, that was just one city. There were dozens of cities that were devastated just as badly, just in Poland alone. Hundreds of cities across Europe equally devastated. So the physical destruction was really quite shocking. I mean, when British and American officials went across to mainland Europe after the war was over, they were kind of expecting it to look a little bit like London did, which was bombed by the Germans during the Blitz. So they were kind of
Keith, are you with us?
Sorry?
Oh, continue. You dropped out for just a moment. You were saying that Americans and British officials who went to the mainland of Europe expected it to look like London.
Yes, they did. They thought that it would be destruction on a similar kind of scale. I mean, they kind of knew that it wouldn't be, but psychologically, that was what they were prepared for. Mm-hmm. So when they arrived in Europe and saw what it really looked like, I mean, all the letters that they wrote home at the time and the diaries that they wrote, I mean, their sense of shock really shines through. Words like Armageddon, apocalypse, Judgment Day, these appear again and again in the writings that they made at the time.
And of course, in many of these places, there were not functional local institutions, local governments to even coordinate reconstruction efforts.
Yeah, I mean, that was, if anything, worse than the physical destruction. The fact that all the institutions had been swept away, so you've got no governments, you've got no police forces, you've got no banking system anymore, you've got no post office, no communications, no trains, I mean, really nothing. Large parts of Europe had no institutions at all. So there was just chaos. I mean, trying to get anything done was impossible in parts of Europe.
And at the same time, Keith, you have quite literally millions of people on the move looking for lost loved ones, looking for safety, looking to see if they could just find a place to call home.
Yes. I mean, during the war, the Germans had taken around about 8 million people from other parts of Europe and brought them into Germany to make up for the labor shortages they had, because, of course, all their men were out in the army. So suddenly, at the end of the war, you have these 8 million people just in Germany who can't get home. They're just sort of wandering around. A lot of them try and walk home vast distances. But of course, they can't really do that. And they're sort of aimless people wandering around Germany at the end of the war. And that's just Germany. I mean, other countries were almost as bad.
What sort of able-bodied workforce was around to help rebuild the continent?
Well, most of the work initially had to be done by Allied soldiers. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really anybody else that could be called upon. They also got German prisoners of war and put them to work. Then later on, various different countries rounded up civilians, particularly German civilians, to do the work. But, you know, you can imagine, so many people have been killed. I mean, we're talking 35 to 40 million people killed during the war, just in Europe. So there's a massive labor shortage all across the continent.
And hunger is an incredibly serious problem at this time.
Yes, absolutely. There was a virtual famine all across Europe. I mean, most famously, it was in the Netherlands, where in the last months of the war, there was really nothing to eat at all. I mean, they did have an official ration, but in reality, there was just no food in the shops. And people were reduced to eating tulip bulbs in the Netherlands as a consequence of this. They used to go out into the countryside and try and swap their watches or their carpets or an oil painting or anything they could swap with a farmer for some food, they would do so. And you know, the same thing happened all across Europe. There are some really terrible stories of the famine that happened in Italy, especially around Naples after the war, and indeed during the war.
Was the problem a failure of production, or were distribution channels interrupted, and therefore what did get produced couldn't get shipped out to people who needed the food?
Well, both, really. The production was really badly hit because there weren't enough people to work the fields. So, you know, really, it was women and children working the fields at the end of the war. And a lot of these women and children had no real interest in doing a good job of it because they didn't know how long they were going to be there. A lot of them were displaced people anyway. But then as soon as they had produced any food, getting it to the people in the cities was really difficult because all of the train lines and transport systems had been bombed during the war. So there was no way of distributing it to the places where it was needed most.
It would seem that after something like the Holocaust, that there would be great sympathy and empathy for surviving Jewish populations. But as it turns out, there was a long legacy of anti-Semitism throughout much of Europe, and that continued after the war.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. All the propaganda that had been spouted by the Germans, by the Nazis during the war, was still very fresh in everybody's minds. But, you know, anti-Semitism had been alive in Europe for centuries, so in some ways it was nothing new. And just because the war was over, I mean, there was no incentive to suddenly start being nice to Jews. In fact, quite the opposite, because when all the Jewish communities had been removed from large parts of Europe and sent off to concentration camps or chased out of the country or whatever it may be, all their property was then shared out amongst the local populations. So the last thing they wanted was these people to come back. Of course, they would have to give their property back. So when they did come back, there was a lot of tension between the returning Jews and the local people who wanted to keep their hands on their property.
So to what extent did those lingering anti-Jewish sentiments have an effect on European support for the establishment of the State of Israel?
Well, European support is an interesting one. I mean, the Americans supported the support of the State of Israel, the creation of the State of Israel, very early on.
Sure.
But then, of course, it suited them to have refugees going off to Palestine, as it was then called, because then they wouldn't be coming across the Atlantic over to America. The British, on the other hand, really didn't want the establishment of Israel to be something which was done in a hurry, because they themselves were in control of Palestine. They were trying to control the local Arab populations, and there were all kinds of tensions already between Arabs and Jews before 1948. They tried their best to keep the Jews in Europe and not allow them to come across to Palestine. There was also, a moral argument for this. I mean, a lot of British people did say that, if you allow all the Jews to flee Europe, then kind of, in a way, Hitler's won, hasn't he? I mean, he's got his aim of having a Jew-free Europe. And so they thought there was a sort of moral reason why you shouldn't allow all the Jews to flee in one go.
What was life like for surviving Jews within Germany itself as compared with other parts of the continent?
Well, ironically, Germany was probably the safest place for Jews after the war, because there they had specially designated camps to gather them all together, to rehabilitate them, and so on. Jews who returned to places like Poland or Hungary or Romania didn't really have any of that. There was no infrastructure put in place for them. There was no real infrastructure put in place for any displaced people, but especially not for Jews. Whereas in Germany, there was very quickly the United Nations set up all kinds of displaced persons camps. And after a lot of pressure, particularly from American Jews, they started separating Jews into separate camps. Before about September 1945, all the Jews were housed with people of other nationalities, and there were all kinds of tensions carried on between them. So they were given their own specially designated Jewish camps from September onwards.
And they were free to come and go from those camps as they pleased?
They were fairly free. I mean, they had to keep a lid on allowing completely free movement, because partly because the people inside these displaced persons camps, they got good rations from the United Nations, much better rations than the people outside the camps in suburban and rural Germany got. So there was a real problem of black marketeering, people trading their stuff, their food, outside with the local German population. And also, there was a lot of revenge going on as well, people going out and looting and attacking local populations. So because of the minority who did that kind of thing, they tried to control the movements of not only Jews, but all displaced persons.
My guest is historian Keith Lowe. He's author of the new book, Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we invite you to call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian and author Keith Lowe. His new book is called Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Gus in Denton. Hello, Gus.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Two comments. First, I've read about two-thirds of the book, and I really like it. One of the reasons I really like it is I went to Germany in 1948 as a 14-year-old teenager, and his descriptions of what I saw and experienced are extremely accurate. I remember DPs wandering about. I remember people looking for food and garbage.
Do you mind if I ask us what you were doing there at 14?
My father was military.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very small high school in Bremerhaven up on the coast. Never more than 50 students. We were just sort of there being teenagers.
What an amazing time in life to experience something like this. Keith, I know you had a chance to speak to some people who are still alive, who lived through this period in history. Can you talk about how those interviews informed the flavor of the book?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's all very well getting hold of facts and statistics and so on. But speaking to people like Gus, who actually experienced these things and saw them for themselves. I mean, that's what gives the real flavor of what it was like to live at this time. I mean, the one person that I interviewed who always springs to mind when people ask me this is a guy called Andrzej, who was a Polish, he's now a man, but he was a child at the time. He was only 9 years old when the war was finished. And he grew up in Germany, living in displaced persons camps, because he couldn't really go back to Poland because it was communist now. He didn't want to go. His mother didn't want to go back there. But he wasn't really allowed to go anywhere else. So until the 1950s, he was living in a displaced persons camp in Germany. And he told me he used to go out into the woods and find bits of ammunition lying around and set fire to it and watch the explosions. He found a Panzerfaust once, which was, he said, is like a sort of small German bazooka. And he and his friends used to just fire this thing across the valley and watch the explosions on the other side. So this is the kind of atmosphere he was growing up in. Weapons were everywhere and chaos was everywhere, and there was nobody really looking after him, nobody really supervising his actions.
So Andrzej was Polish but living in Germany. There were, of course, a lot of ethnic Germans living in other parts of Europe that were no longer welcome, that were harshly and summarily expelled from the countries where, in some cases, their families had lived for generations.
Yeah, absolutely. There were Europe in at the beginning of the 20th century was a very different place. There were empires, not really countries. So different nationalities spread out everywhere. So there were Germans living all across Europe and had been living there for, in places like Poland or Czechoslovakia or Hungary, Romania, all over the place. But now the war had finished. These people were not welcome anymore, and they were expelled from those countries into Germany. It's estimated that around 16 million Germans from other parts of Europe were expelled into Germany after the war. So you can imagine what a toll that would take on the infrastructure of a country which has been completely bombed and destroyed. I mean, there's no housing left for these people. There's no food. So competition for resources is fierce already before these 16 million people arrive.
There's also this question of national identity and how the Germans were able to sort of reform any semblance of of being a single nation, which, of course, they were bifurcated not long after this. But can you talk a little bit about that?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, all these Germans from other countries were, you know, they were not really welcomed by the Germans who had always lived in Germany. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of respects, they weren't regarded really as Germans at all. And, you know, they were regarded as Poles or Hungarians or whatever. And they spoke funny, you know. They didn't speak German the same way that Reich Germans spoke. So they had to be sort of subsumed into society very slowly. It did help to have a common enemy in the Cold War to allow the Germans to sort of, you know, reestablish themselves as a friendly nation and as a single, well, I say a single nation, but of course East Germany was always separate until 1989. It was difficult. It was a difficult time for that kind of thing.
Tell us a little bit about the fate of German military prisoners taken into custody before or at the end of the war.
Well, it really depended on who took the Germans prisoner. So if they were taken prisoner by the Soviets, they were in for a really hard time. I can't remember the exact percentage. I think it's around 40% of German prisoners taken by the Soviets never came back. Hmm. So, you know, they were sent off to gulags, they were sent to labor camps, and some of them were just executed. So, yeah, it was tough if you were taken prisoner by the Soviets. It was also really tough if you were taken prisoner by the Yugoslavs, who were ruthless. And you know, in some ways, understandably, I mean, Yugoslavia had been treated so badly by the German army that, you know, revenge on German soldiers after the war was rife. But if, on the other hand, you were taken prisoner by the Western Allies, the French or the British or the Americans, you had a better deal. You had a much better chance of survival. You know, things weren't good. You had to, especially at the immediate aftermath of the war, there were German prisoners put in camps as big as 100,000, 120,000 people. And, you know, for weeks there would be no sanitation, no proper food and so on. So survival rates weren't quite what they should have been, but they were a lot better than they were in the East.
There was a great deal of anger against women who had formed relationships with invading German soldiers. They became sort of overnight pariahs. Talk about the kinds of punishments that were dealt to them, and in some cases, if they happened to bear children, to their children.
Yeah, I mean there was during the war, there were a lot of women who slept with German soldiers. I mean it was not something that any in particular country tried to advertise after the war. They tried to play it down, but actually it happened everywhere and to a huge degree. I mean, in Norway, for example, it's probably about 10% of women of marriageable age had a German boyfriend during the war.
And I want to jump in just to be clear, because people know that sexual violence is often a crime of war. You're speaking here about consensual relationships.
No, this is consensual relationships. And in Denmark, and there was a woman who did a clandestine survey. She was in the resistance during the war of other Danish women, and she found that 51% of them, in other words, more than half, found German men more attractive than their own compatriots. So there was a sort of, I don't know, some kind of Darwinian thing going on where, you know, these dominant military men were seen as somehow attractive. So it wasn't always force. You know, there was a lot of rape and so on, especially in Eastern Europe. But in Western Europe, there was a lot of consensual sex going on between local women and German men. It was a very big problem. So after the war, you can imagine how the local men felt about these women. They felt betrayed. They felt sort of powerless. And they wanted to get their own back. So they gathered these women and the usual punishment was to sort of drag her in front of the community, usually in the sort of in the town square or somewhere, and quite often they'd strip her naked or almost naked, really to humiliate her, and then they would shave her hair off. So this happened. It's really surprising, actually. I mean, it's famously happened in France, where about 20,000 women had their heads shaved. But it wasn't just France. It happened all over Europe. Everywhere seemed to have the same kind of punishment. I don't know whether there's some psychological thing about women's hair or something, but it happened everywhere.
Did any of that cruelty and revenge help to bring catharsis, or is it the sense of people who lived through that time that it simply just had the effect of prolonging the time that Europe needed to sort of heal from all of this?
Well, actually, with the punishment of women, there was a very real sense that it was kind of bringing the community back together again. It's very strange, really. It's like they're becoming unified again through vengeance. You know, you have these women who are made scapegoats for the crimes of all the community because, you know, everybody really collaborated with the Germans. I mean, almost everybody. But if you can blame it on these women and produce a punishment which isn't, you know, that they considered it as something quite mild, really. It wasn't like executing them. There was a lot of that going on as well, by the way. But women were seen as a kind of safety valve for the community. If you could shave their hair off, then justice was done and everyone could go back to normal, was the thought behind it.
We have an email here from Charles who asks, was there any concerted effort to make Europe ungovernable after the war, such as after the American Civil War, there were criminal gangs in the West and Arkansas, or Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, concerted efforts to make Europe ungovernable, kind of, yes. I mean, there were criminal gangs everywhere because when you have a power vacuum and there's nobody in charge, there's no police forces and so on, crime will happen because it's profitable and it's easy and there's no one to stop you. But you know, when it comes to criminals, they don't have necessarily a motive of destabilizing things. They're just out for the money. On the other hand, there were also communist groups of resistance fighters and so on who they saw an opportunity at the end of the war to seize power. And, you know, they really didn't want the Allies coming in and reestablishing control because it wasn't their control. It was foreign control, and it wasn't communist control. So there were some small attempts to destabilize parts of southern France, parts of central and northern Italy, and, of course, in parts of eastern Europe where the communists did gain control. So there was a sort of political groups who were out to destabilize things further for political gain, yes.
Tell us about the kind of power and the tactics used by the Red Army in the territories that were under Soviet control.
Well, there you go. This is really a lesson in how to gain totalitarian control over a country quickly. The Red Army took over the whole of Eastern Europe. They were unassailable. And the first thing they did was to make sure that they had no competition. So in Poland, for example, they made sure that the local resistance, which was very strong, the Polish Home Army was a huge organization. They made sure that they were disarmed. They had to either hand themselves in, hand their weapons in, and so on. In other countries like Romania, there was an official army who had changed sides during the war and were supposed to be allies of the Red Army. But again, they made sure that they were to a large degree, disarmed. And then as soon as they got control, military control over the countries that they had occupied, They then set about making sure they had social control by infiltrating all the police forces. So this was the most important thing, was to give the semblance of a democracy. So you allow other political parties to take important positions in the government, like, you know, the prime minister or the president, but you make sure that you get control of the police forces, so the interior ministry or the justice ministry and so on. Once you've got control of the sort of social forces of justice, then, well, everything, it's like dominoes, everything falls from there on.
Keith, was it immediately clear to local populations what was happening, or was there a brief time in which they felt as if, okay, someone is coming in who can take control, who can provide some semblance of order, and perhaps things will improve from here?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, there were huge parts of the population of Eastern Europe who really welcomed the Red Army. I mean, they were being liberated. And not only that, they also welcomed communism. There was, I mean, if you take Czechoslovakia, for an example, they had a free and fair election where 38% of the people voted for the Communist Party. I mean, they were more than happy to have communists come because they perceived them as righting all kinds of social wrongs, which had been done in the decades before the war. So there were all kinds of peasants and poor people and you know, factory workers and so on, who actually welcomed the communists, which is something we tend to forget. On the other hand, there were large sections of the population who were really feared the communists. I mean, they weren't stupid. They had seen what had happened during other communist revolutions around Europe in the wake of the First World War. And they were really worried about what was going to happen now in the wake of the second one.
My guest is historian Keith Lowe. He is author of the new book Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian and author Keith Lowe. His new book is called Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, Keith, when we talk about, you know, peace following the end of the war, there was not peace throughout much of Europe. It wasn't simply a matter of tension. There was armed conflict in places like Poland and Greece and Yugoslavia.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the problem is that we have a very narrow idea of what the Second World War was. I mean, we normally think of it as a simple battle between the Allies and Germany. But actually, when you get down to the individual countries in Europe, there were all kinds of other things going on. So there was often there were ethnic wars between local ethnic populations, especially in places like Poland or Yugoslavia or Ukraine. Then there were also, there's this whole communist thing going on. A lot of the resistance that happened during the war, a lot of the best resistance, came from the communists. Now, their agenda is not just to beat the Germans and then leave it at that. Of course, they want to create a communist state afterwards. So just because Germany's defeated, there's no incentive for them to stop fighting. They carry on fighting for as long as it's going to take, or until they're defeated. So, yes, there was a lot of violence which continued after we imagined the war had finished.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ellis, calling from North Dallas. Hi, Ellis.
Hi. Pleasure talking to you. We lived in the East Village back in the early 60s. That's the part of Manhattan that's bounded by what we call Houston Street on the south and St. Mark's Place on the north, east of 3rd Avenue. And you had a large Ukrainian population there. Now, I knew many of them. They're decent people. But also harbored in there was supposedly forced labor, and I use that term in quotes. These were actually volunteer Ukrainian workers who worked in the, you know, in Germany. And they were as pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic as any. I mean, some of them were brazenly anti-Semitic. And they were let in the name of anti-communism. And it wasn't only from the Ukraine. You had Poles of that stripe, and a lot of other East Europeans. Do you recall any of this, or do you have any comment on what our immigration policy was post-World War II?
Thanks for your call.
I can say that you were kind of unlucky, I suppose, in the States, because these are the people who had to be had to come in. You know, the Ukrainians who were happy to accept the local situation tended to stay, whereas the ones who were fiercely nationalistic and you know, anti-Semitic and anti-Polish and so on, the reason they got involved in the war was, and the reason they volunteered for things with the Nazis is was not because they openly supported the Nazis necessarily, although a lot of them did. Their real motive was to create a Ukraine, because Ukraine didn't exist before the war, and indeed it only kind of existed in name as a part of the Soviet Union after the war. They wanted a completely independent Ukraine, and they their vision of what this Ukraine would look like was very specific. I mean, it was only going to be peopled with Ukrainians. There would be no Polish people in there. There would be no Jews in there. It would just be normal Christian Ukrainians and nobody else. So during the war, they became more and more extreme in the way they fought for this. So there was a sort of virtual civil war going on in Ukraine during the war between Ukrainians and Poles. But also, you know, Ukrainians were quite happy to exterminate Jews as well, because they didn't want them either. So these extreme Ukrainians are the ones who had to flee after the war. So where do they go? I mean, first they go to Germany, and they say that they were forced laborers, and they try to go anywhere apart from back to Ukraine because they know that they'll be punished as soon as they get there. So, you know, the lucky ones escaped and got to America and met you in Manhattan.
One thing that was really interesting about reading this book, Keith, was this idea that hadn't really occurred to me, that Germans themselves, who had lived within Germany, felt very persecuted in the years after the war and as if they had been unfairly treated.
In the years after the war, yes. They did. You've got to remember that Germany was made much smaller after the war. As a sort of punishment, they removed a large area of German territory and gave it to Poland. I mean, this was part of the reason for Germans being transported into Germany from Poland after the war, is because that bit of Poland actually used to be Germany. Mm-hmm. So the way that these people were expelled was incredibly brutal. I mean, there were a lot of. It's very difficult to know how many people died along the way, but it at least numbers in the hundreds of thousands. So yes, they felt very hard done in the aftermath of the war, and they used this to their advantage in a way. I mean, they used it as a distraction for the things that they themselves had done during the war.
So essentially, it kept them. It kept, you know, Nazis from soul searching about their culpability.
Yeah, exactly. If you can believe that you yourself are a victim, then you're not going to worry too much about the things that you might have done earlier on in the war, are you? It's a very good way of avoiding worrying about the crimes that you yourself have committed.
How long did it take the Marshall Plan to begin to be effective in restoring infrastructure and economies, at least in the portions of Europe that were controlled by the Allies?
Well, we have to remember the Marshall Plan didn't even kick in until 1948. So there was a good few years where you know, not a great deal was being done to stimulate the economy and rebuild and so on. But you know, once the money started coming in, and it wasn't only money that the Marshall Plan provided. It was also a framework whereby European states could all work together. I mean, this was really the forerunner of today's European Union. It was born in the Marshall Plan, because those were the conditions of the Marshall Plan. Nobody would get any money unless they all worked together. So this really laid the foundations for people to start rebuilding. But, you know, they still had rationing in Britain up into the 1950s. So, you know, things didn't change overnight by any stretch of the imagination.
I gather that you are British. Is that correct?
I am. That's right.
All right. Can you talk a little bit about the different perspective on the years following the war between people who are British and those who lived in other parts of the continent?
Well, we have a not a completely dissimilar way of looking at it to you guys in the States. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did get bombed and we had hardship here and so on. But you know, compared to the rest of Europe, we did have it quite easy. We didn't get invaded, so we kind of feel like we've got the moral high ground. We feel, you know, we were the victors. We were the ones who won the war. Whereas if you're, you know, French, you can try and believe that, but you know deep down that you had to be bailed out by the British and Americans. Mm-hmm. If you're Italian, again, you try and ignore the history which led you to being on the wrong side, and so on. So in mainland Europe, there's a sort of feeling of guilt and a sort of reluctance to talk about certain things. Whereas in Britain and in America, we love talking about the Second World War. I mean, it's kind of a national industry. We have it everywhere. It's on television every day. It's in the newspapers all the time. I mean, I was walking through Manhattan not so long ago, and there was that photograph I told you about at the beginning, you know, the one of the dealer kissing the nurse in Times Square. Huge, great big mural of it on a wall in New York, in West Manhattan. This is something which we live with every day and are comfortable with, whereas in Europe, they're not comfortable with the Second World War. They still aren't even today.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that image, which is so iconic and does sort of, it stands as a sort of shorthand for so many of us in this part of the world for the end of the war. The photographs in your book are of bombed buildings and starving children, emaciated children, and women yeah. living in caves. A very, very different set of images.
Yeah, I mean, we like to think of the end of the war being full of happy, smiling people celebrating and so on. And there are plenty of photographs of that. And it did happen, but, you know, it was kind of short-lived in Europe, very short-lived, because the reality was so much worse. I got a lot of those photographs in the book from the United Nations archive, they sent photographers around Europe photographing conditions there, and there are precious little photographs of people celebrating there. I can tell you, in the whole archive, you really won't find photographs of that. Instead, you see these pictures of emaciated children and you know, people with quite somber expressions on their faces.
Why are we just now beginning to closely study this moment in history?
Well, I have no idea. It baffles me. I mean, I that's what the main reason why I wrote this book, because it seemed like such a huge gap that, you know, our standard narrative of the war comes to an end on May the 8th, 1945. And then what happens? I mean, everything goes back to normal? Of course it does. So it is very strange that nobody's really spent a great deal of time looking at this in this way. I mean, they have in individual countries, but nobody's really sort of drawn it all together to show how the same themes and the same violence is happening all across Europe after the war is supposed to have finished.
Does this suggest, do you think, that we believe that we've achieved some degree of understanding of World War II itself, that we're ready now to move on to what appears to be equally, if not a more complicated moment in time?
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, I think it's important to see the war as not, I mean, particularly the end of the war, not as a single moment, but as a process, you know. These things take time. They don't happen overnight. And if you do see it as a process, you get a much more realistic picture, perhaps a more uncomfortable one. I mean, there are some really unpleasant in this book, but it, at least a more realistic picture of what life looks like when all the institutions have been swept away.
This book is a work of history and not a policy prescription, but I wonder if your research suggested to you some lessons we can take from the suffering of post-war Europe that could be applied to places emerging from active conflict in the present day.
Well, you mean sort of places like Iraq and Afghanistan,
yeah,
and so on. Simply that, you know, these things take time, and you won't get a stable society until there is proper control, whether that's a totalitarian control like the Soviets. I mean, that worked, too. Or a proper, more consensual control, whereby you have all different groups all gathering together in an attempt to get sort of national unity. Unless you've got that, you're not going to get anywhere. But even if you do have that, it's still going to take time. It took Europe years, decades even, before it managed to pull itself back together again.
And it did pull itself back together rather than having sort of solutions applied from afar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Marshall Plan helped, but you're not going to have, nobody's going to make anything work if they're being made to do it, which is one of the main reasons why Western Europe recovered so much more quickly than Eastern Europe did. Mm. Because, you know, in the West, we were doing it voluntarily. We were all in it together and we were working towards a common goal. Whereas, you know, in the East, people were being doing what they were told. And if you do what you're told, you don't do it as well as if you do what you want to. So, yeah.
I'm sorry we have to jump in here. Keith Lowe is a historian and author of the book Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II. Keith, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. If you want to check out upcoming programs or download the podcast, you can do that free at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.